Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program takes us to Portland and the Muskie School of Business at USM for a speech by Joel Berg. The title of his speech and his book is All You Can Eat, How Hungry is America? Berg is a leading national expert on U.S. hunger, and we'll talk about how the budget passed by Congress and President Obama's policy proposals could help Maine's hungry families. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. There you will find this program and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs as well. Click Audio on Demand or Podcasts for a listing of available programs, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Mark Lapping, Professor of Public Policy and Management at the Muskie School.
Good morning and welcome to Ollie and to the Muskie School. We're delighted today to host Joel Berg, who will be talking a bit about his book, All That You Can Eat. When we just met, he told me he just came from Becky's and had enough food for quite a while, which is endemic of one of the problems in the United States, that if you go out to eat at a restaurant, they tend to really pile it on in absolute excess. I sort of come to this, I do a lot of work on food system research, and one of my claim to fames is after having worked for 5 years as chair of the Economic Development Corporation for the city of Trenton, New Jersey, while I was at Rutgers, I finally got the first supermarket to locate in the capital city of the wealthiest state in the nation. Cities, like a lot of rural areas, tend to be food deserts, in fact, where it's so incredibly difficult to get supplies of fresh food. I also grew up on a farm in Vermont and come to it even more particularly because my daughter is in charge of nutrition and food interventions for Save the Children for Southeast Asia, and worries a lot about Bangladesh, India, and most especially, or most recently, Vietnam. We tend to think these problems are problems in Bangladesh, and we tend not to think of these problems of hunger as American problems. Just a couple of things. As a ruralist, I can tell you, no one goes to sleep hungrier than rural children in the United States, and particularly rural Native American children on reservations, which is still one of America's greatest shames, I believe. But here in the state of Maine, almost all of us, I think, as Mainers recognize that there are pockets of very, very deep, persistent, and chronic poverty in the state. One interesting statistic: between the year 2000 and 2005, the number of rural children moving into poverty was higher, grew at a higher rate in Maine than in any other state in the United States. Yes, worse than Mississippi, worse than Alabama and the deep South states that we have long been compared to in terms of rates of poverty. And, of course, what poverty means, it translates itself and manifests itself in many ways. Poor access to services, relatively poor housing, fewer economic, educational, health service opportunities, but most especially in terms of hunger. And the number of children who go to sleep hungry, who go to school hungry, and a true manifestation of the incredible amount of persistent poverty which still exists in Maine and in the United States in general. It's entirely appropriate, then, that we have a leading advocate for better food systems and feeding systems in the United States in Joel Berg, who heads the New York City Coalition that works on these issues most specifically. So without any further ado, we welcome Joel Berg with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. I want to thank first the Junior League of Portland for inviting me here to speak. They started the ball rolling, and they do great work, and I really honor them for making fighting hunger a top priority. I also want to thank the Muskie School. It is truly an honor to be speaking at some place named after Ed Muskie. Now, later in my talk, I'll actually talk about how Richard Nixon became, perhaps unwittingly, one of the heroes of the anti-hunger movement. And that's sort of one of the positive highlights of his career. Obviously, at anything named after Edward Muskie, I'm reminded of many of you lowlights, including how he absolutely slimed Muskie during the 72 presidential race and beforehand. As you probably know, the story of the Canuck letter, Richard Nixon's folks actually forged a letter that was supposed to be from Muskie that had bad things to say about Franco-American voters in New Hampshire, and the rest is history. So I'll get to that in a bit, but I have a chapter called Richard Nixon, Despot, Thief, Crook, and one of America's greatest hunger fighters. So there you have it. I also want to thank Public Radio for carrying this, and for those of you who are listening, send in your pledge checks today. If you're listening, you're getting free radio and send in your fair share. And I must say, traveling around the country with newspapers disappearing faster than you can say, hold the presses, one of the few outlets actually covering my book and covering the issue of hunger consistently is Public Radio around the country. So as I talk today about the role of government in ending hunger, we see that government does a number of useful things, including supporting public radio that will actually devote an hour to a serious discussion of poverty and hunger. Isn't that shocking? Now, I'll start with just my handful of Maine jokes. I know it's dicey here, but I'll try. As a New Yorker, starting with Maine jokes, how many Mainers does it take to screw in a light bulb? Answer, that's kind of a personal question, don't you think? I also want to say, I'm wrapping up my book tour. I've literally gone from Alaska to Maine and many points in between. And I was in Alaska when a volcano was going off. And I went to a reception there for my book, and some people were regaling me and sort of outdoing themselves with discussing how dangerous the volcanic ash could be. Some people described it as sort of like coal ash, and they said that I could maybe get something like black lung. Other people said, no, it's like fiberglass. It can really rip you apart. Other people said, no, it's like ground glass. It'll turn your lungs into a bloody pulp. And then the next morning, I'm jogging, and I pass by a park, and someone says, there was a moose nearby, and it could have kicked you to death. No stranger to moose here in Maine. And then around the corner, someone told me there was a bear mauling. And then, true story, I'm driving the next day, and there's an avalanche. So I go to another reception, and I tell someone I'm from New York, and they go, New York? Isn't that dangerous? And speaking of which, I Junior League graciously had me in Falmouth last night, and I enter the town, and there's the sign, hunting only with shotguns. And I must say, that's the same sign that when you enter Brooklyn, my hometown, that's what you get. So it really is great to be here. It was great, Professor Lapping, talking about the issue in urban and rural America, being a New Yorker, being the head of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. When I travel around the country, a lot of people think that the problems of rural America are very, very different than the problems of urban America. Now, I don't want to oversimplify things. There are obviously issues of distance and density that are unique, but in my judgment, there are far more commonalities than there are differences. I previously served in the Department of Agriculture in the Clinton administration, and I helped manage some projects in parts of rural Maine, and I spent time here. I spent time in rural white Appalachia, rural African-American Mississippi Delta, some Native American reservations of the Southwest or the Great Plains, and I've just got to tell you, poverty is poverty is poverty. Hunger is hunger is hunger. The same lack of good food, the same amount of food deserts, where even if you can afford good food, it often physically doesn't exist in many rural areas and many urban neighborhoods. The hopelessness, the vacant look in the eyes of children who grew up in families without enough food, I have to unfortunately say, is a lot more similar in rural Maine and rural Appalachia and the rural Mississippi Delta to parts of East New York or South Central LA than we'd like to admit. And the other sad fact about this is the fastest growing population of poverty per capita in America is actually in the suburbs. I grew up in Rockland County, New York, about 30 miles north of New York City. It was a nice bedroom community, upper middle class for New York City. Now, its poverty rate has virtually doubled in the last decade. There are more soup kitchens and food pantries per capita in Rockland County, this leafy suburb, than there are now in New York City. So I want to start today by
disabusing you of the notion this is a problem for the other people. Just a certain group, this is in our era. All 50 states of America have extraordinarily high levels of food insecurity and hunger compared to most developed countries. That's how I want to really start today with a secular parable, what I call the parable of yellow fever, cholera, and malaria. Last night I said this over dinner, so I feel a little less guilty. And by the way, before starting, I've got to say about Becky's, it was very large portions, but for the record, it was excellent food. One of the best breakfasts we've ever had, so it'll fuel me for quite a while. Now, I want you to imagine that this is not 2009. I want you to imagine this is the late 1700s, and I want you to come visit me in my hometown of New York City. Whatever it's going to take, whether you'll have to take a clipper, you know, for a few weeks, or, you know, a horse for a few weeks, whatever you're going to take. New York, even in the 1790s, was a great town. Come visit. What would you see? You'd see people dying everywhere of yellow fever. It's a miserable disease. The death rate was so high that the death rate from yellow fever dwarfed the death rate from HIV and AIDS in the height of the AIDS epidemic in New York City in the 80s and 90s. Further south in the United States, you go down to Philadelphia, a little past Philadelphia, what was to become Washington, D.C., Savannah, Charleston, New Orleans, what would you see? You'd see people dying everywhere of malaria. Now, come back up and visit New York in the mid-1800s, and what would you see? You'd see people dying everywhere of cholera. The cholera death rate was so massive it dwarfed even the yellow fever death rate. One year in the 1830s, if you transposed the death rate from cholera to today's New York City, that would be 100,000 people dying a year of cholera. 100,000 people dying a year. That's Madison Square Garden, a great New York institution, filled up five times. One of your hockey stadiums, a lot more than that here. A massive death rate. And the working assumption of most Americans about cholera, yellow fever, and malaria was that they were just a natural part of the Earth's environment. They were like Casco Bay or the Hudson River. See, I always throw in local references. They've always been here. They were created by God. They're inevitable. Human beings have nothing to do with them. And there's certainly nothing human beings can do to end these problems. And so since we can't end these problems, the most we can do, the best we can hope for, is have a little extra charity to make people's lives marginally less miserable as they die horrid, inevitable deaths. And by the way, the elites of our society thought the reason these diseases happened disproportionately to low-income people is because it was low-income people's fault. They were too dirty, they were too drunken, they were too lascivious. And many people actually thought that God was punishing them for the sin of being poor. And that's what people believed about these diseases. Now, show of hands, you didn't know you were going to get a test, and I'll have to walk people through this for radio. Raise your hands if while in the United States, exclude any of you guys who've been in the Peace Corps or traveling overseas in the developed world, raise your hands if while in the United States, any one of you have ever contracted yellow fever, malaria, or cholera. For the record, for the radio audience, I feel like a court reporter, no one raised their hand. Okay, let's expand that, because if this was a few hundred years ago, every one of you would raise your hand, most of you would have. Raise your hand if you've ever met anyone who's contracted yellow fever, cholera, or malaria in the United States. For the record, we have maybe 50, 40 people in the audience. Not one person raised their hand. If this was a few hundred years ago, every hand, every one of you would have known countless people with these diseases. They are warm weather diseases. And the fact that it's supposed to be in the 80s or 90s here in Portland today, and New Englanders are freaking out. They didn't know there were that many digits on the, on a thermometer, is further proof that North America is getting warmer. So these are warm weather diseases. North America is getting warmer. And we know these diseases are still prevalent throughout much of the developing world, but they don't exist here anymore. What happened? Where'd they go? Why doesn't the United States have cholera, malaria, or yellow fever anymore? Why? Government wipe them out. Government, wipe them out. Yes, that evil, horrible, occupying force government. If you believe the teabaggers, government does nothing except steal our money and throw it away. Yes, government, acting on our behalf as citizens, actually used to solve major social problems. Don't believe me? Government scientists played a lead in figuring out that yellow fever and malaria were caused by a certain kind of mosquitoes, and we developed national programs to eradicate these mosquitoes. Now, those programs had side effects with pesticides, but we eventually dealt with that. But their main goal of wiping out these diseases worked. Cholera is an even better example. Cholera is created by human communities. We figured out that cholera was created by bad community water. So city after city, county after county, state after state, developed massive government-run systems to bring fresh water into cities and bad water out. Now, New York City has among the best fresh water in the United States we brag about. You know, it is a massive system, the Croton Reservoir system, that brings water sometimes from hundreds of miles away in the Catskill Mountains into New York City. This water's done a lot of things. We brag it gives us the best bagels and pizza in the world. Now, there's some pretty good pizza in Portland, but not to have too much of a side, can I talk to you just a second about your bagels? Bad news for you, bagels are not white bread with a hole. Just, an aside, sorry. But I'll give you your lobster rolls, no question about it, and all sorts of gourmet food. So this water's given New York among the best bagels and pizza in the country. It also did something else. It eliminated cholera overnight. You can go to the website of the New York City Department of Health and find a chart called Death from Pestilence in New York City. Is that a fun title or what? That's almost as good as All You Can Eat. Death from Pestilence in New York City. And you will actually see there a chart that's showing cholera going up, 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 up. The Croton Reservoir is built. Fresh water comes into New York City. Boom. Cholera goes away overnight. Now, you came here for a hunger talk, not a public health talk. Some of you are going, what the heck is he talking about? We're here to talk about hunger. What does this have to do with hunger? My contention is the same failed, demonstrably wrong assumptions we had a few hundred years ago about major diseases are the same failed, demonstrably wrong assumptions we have today about hunger and poverty. Americans still think they're just a natural part of the human environment. They sort of were always here and always will be. They'll be immutable and fixed. They significantly misread the portions of the Bible that say the poor will always be with us, which really means it's always our job to eradicate poverty, not that we should accept what's here. But they believe that it's always here and there's nothing we can do about it and that it never changes. That's just factually not true, and that's one of the main themes of my book. I demonstrate that poverty in America and hunger in America have gone up or down over time because of government actions and economic actions controlled by society. There are parts of this world today that have virtually no hunger. Parts of Northern Europe, parts of Western Europe have virtually no hunger. There are parts of this world that have far more hunger than the United States. I submit the biggest difference is not natural resources. The biggest difference is how societies are organized and how resources are allocated. Let me be very specific about poverty. You've heard the myth that the war on poverty was a total failure. It didn't work. The Great Society didn't work. It shocks me. Even liberals, progressives I talk to, just believe that. They've been told it, so they believe it. It's not true. And let's talk facts. Federal government data. Between 1960 and 1973, the poverty rate in America was cut in half. Between 1960 and 1973, the poverty rate in America was cut in half. 16 million Americans left poverty and entered the middle class. Permit me to suggest that we didn't lose the war on poverty because it was failing, that we lost it because we stopped fighting it. Now, let me talk specifically about hunger. This is sort of billed as a reading. So in addition to my ranting, I'll read you something. And by the way, this book, which is excellent, we New Yorkers are not shy about promoting our own greatness, so I urge you to buy the book. I'm just going to give you the highlights today because, as my mother would say, if you give the milk away, buy the cow. Although my mother, we liked eating so much, she'd say, buy the cow and give the milk away. And some of the proceeds are going to the Junior League's anti-hunger program, so I'm not getting money from it, so I urge you to get this. But I just want to read you a quote from 1910, because I think it's vital to understand that things have actually gotten better in America since 1910. And sometimes advocates are loath to admit anything ever gets better, because we think our job is to just make people think it gets worse and worse and worse and worse forever. And some people are saying today's worse than the Great Depression. That's poppycock. And I don't want to diminish today's economic hardship for the people suffering from it. It is massive, and it's not just a statistic, but it's nothing like the Great Depression, partially because we have a safety net now that we did not have then. And number one, I don't think progressives should just say, well, sometimes conservatives make stuff up, so we can exaggerate, and that's fine. And number two, just as a practical organizing matter, if you really want to help people understand that organizing matters, that change can accomplish something meaningful, you have to show examples from history where organizing and change actually made a real difference. So you've heard, I hope, of the name Frances Perkins. She was the first female cabinet secretary in U.S. history, but beyond that, she did some incredible things. She helped write the Social Security Act. She helped write the first national minimum wage legislation. But it turns out the most significant thing she did in her entire career was write a master's thesis in 1910 that could be a centerpiece of my book. And the title of her thesis was A Study in Malnutrition, 107 Children from Public School 51. Study in malnutrition and 107 children from public school 51. That's even a catchier title still than All You Can Eat, I gotta tell you. And she literally went with some doctors and studied kids in what was then called the Hell's Kitchen neighborhood of Manhattan. It was mostly Irish and Italian slum. Since then, it's been transformed by realtors into the Clinton section of Manhattan, because Hell's Kitchen doesn't sell as many condos. But then it was a pretty tough neighborhood, and she really studied what these kids were eating. In the back of the thesis, she had her day's equivalent of a spreadsheet done by hand, a chart, and she laid out each of these kids what they were eating on a daily basis. They often would have coffee or tea with every meal. That's what kids were eating then in these neighborhoods. Not to be ethnically stereotypical, but that's what she found, that Irish kids would maybe have a little potatoes. Italian kids would maybe have a little polenta. They would rarely have a sandwich, maybe a little bread, almost never meat, and never, ever, ever virtually fresh produce in any way, shape, or form, and virtually never could their families afford milk. And they were literally starving to death, or very, very, very seriously malnourished, as you might see in Somalia or North Korea today. And let me just read you one quote, because this is a reading. One of the children was an Italian boy with a continual pain in his chest and a bad cough, which lasted 2 years. The father is a cobbler, making $7 or $8 a week, and the family lives in the basement rooms back of the shop. The lad with the pain in his chest lives in the semi-dark, damp room and eats little besides macaroni, bread, and coffee. One further element of hopelessness is that he has now turned 14, he has taken his working papers, and must get a factory job at once. Child labor isn't legal in America anymore, so there's still a little of it at the edges, but not so much so. We don't have kids starving like that, because in 1910 there wasn't a federal food stamp program. There is today. 1910 there wasn't a federal women's infants and children program, WIC program. There is today. 1910 there was no government school lunch or school breakfast program. There is today. Even though these programs are underutilized, and I'll talk about that, they still exist. 1910 no government after school snacks program, no government summer meals programs. Food pantries, which served boxed and canned foods to working families, didn't exist in America then. And I'll get to in a minute, they didn't even exist till the 1980s. Soup kitchens, the few sort of missions that existed in America, were basically on the skid rows of America, and they got no government money. Things are better for even the hungriest children in America today, by and large, than they were in 1910. So you thought you'd be depressed, I have good news. You know, things got worse again in the Depression, but Franklin Roosevelt created the pilot food stamps program there. He created the Civilian Conservation Corps, which in addition to paying people a buck a day to do work in our communities and on park and natural and public lands, also gave people a meal. And we forget that was a key component of the CCC. You were getting meals for your work. That all helped. But still, following World War II, there was so much widespread malnourishment in America that generals came to President Truman and said, Mr. President, Our boys are too malnourished to fight. We have young men coming into induction centers all across America, and they're so malnourished they're just not fit enough to join the armed forces. As a result, President Truman and Congress created the National School Lunch Program in the late 1940s as a national defense mechanism. That significantly helped. One other thing following World War II really helped America's reduction of poverty and hunger was the GI Bill. Hope you know about that. It was a massive government investment that said people who served this country in the armed forces could get government help with a down payment on a first home, to start a first business, or to go to college. Turns out my father was the first person on his side of the family to be able to go to college because he served in World War II and got help from the GI Bill. The GI Bill was one of the great engines of post-war economic growth in America, and I contend the GI Bill was one of the reasons we had the great American middle class. For you young students here, I'll stand around signing books later and I'll explain what the middle class meant. We used to have one in America. We don't have one anymore, but I'll have to explain, what that meant. So even people say, oh, when we reduce poverty, it's economic growth. I agree. And I actually agree the single greatest engine of poverty reduction and hunger reduction should be the creation of living wage private sector jobs. But do not forget the role that government has historically played in leveling the playing field a little, creating economic opportunity, so the smartest and the hardest working, not just the richest born, can get ahead through their hard work. So all this stuff worked. We had a school meals program. We had the GI Bill. So by the mid-1960s, the late 1960s, we had basically dramatically reduced widespread, fundamental, all over the place malnutrition in America. But by the late 1960s, we still had significant pockets of poverty. You could see it in African-American inner cities and rural areas. You could see it in Native American reservations. You could see it in parts of rural Maine or the rural Northwest. You could still see it in pockets of poverty around America. And these pockets were so severe that they really rivaled third world style conditions. How do we know this? We know this because doctors traveled around the United States and actually measured the extent of poverty and hunger in the United States. And there was one famous doctor, Dr. Raymond Wheeler, who was a doctor who was affiliated with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I was researching his archives online, and most of this research, you're spending years or months to find a little nugget, and most of it's, no offense to you academics here, somewhat boring. But I'm reading this, and it's like field notes, check, research notes, check, testimony, check, hate mail. Hate mail? Who would write hate mail to a pediatrician who had spent his whole career highlighting hunger among small children? So I just saw a summary of this. I sent a small check to the University of North Carolina, the wonderful folks at the library. By the way, if I'm speaking too slowly, speed me up. I'm in Maine, so I'm slowing down my normal New York speaking. So I'm slowing down because I'm down east. So I wrote to them, and they sent me reams and reams of hate mail to this doctor. Pretty phenomenal. I speculated that a lot of it was racist. I had no idea. Let me just read you one from a woman in Neshoba, Mississippi. Doctors, and the grammar and punctuation is theirs, not mine. You'll have to buy the book to see it in full. I have another one here. Actually, in my first draft, before my editor said, calm down, I had 20 of these hate mail letters, and she said, two is enough. They get the idea. Doctors, I want to tell you just how cheap, rotten, lying, disgusting, and contemptible you and all your cohorts are in your most recent liable attacks on Mississippi. If I just didn't know that God will see you will get your true just punishment, I would love to personally take you on myself. The loads of commodities the lazy Negro carries out for the illegitimate children by the dozens and husbands too sorry and too lazy to work and make a living and then drives around in some of the finest cars here and miss, and I can't even afford a car to hold a job with them, such disciples of Satan, forever lying and slinging mud at our midst. All of you are the very lowest caliber of humanity. You're a disgrace to America and the entire medical profession. Now, should you think that racism was just a problem for Mississippi or North Carolina, and just in the 1960s we have an African-American president, all racism is gone, we can all sing Kumbaya, it's just not true. Just a few weeks ago, I did a press conference highlighting the fact that Costco stores still do not accept food stamps. It is bad moral policy, I would suggest, and dumb economic policy. There are tens of billions of dollars nationwide in food stamps benefits that Costco stores could be getting. And I'm one advocate who says, you know, big box stores, I'm not thrilled with some of the things they might do for the environment. I'm not thrilled what they do for wages. But I got to tell you, lower prices are a good thing for poor people and working class people. So progressives who just sort of eschew when it comes to food or anything else, lower prices automatically mean bad. I got to say, anyone who says that isn't poor. Lower prices are good for poor people, and I hope Costco would do the right thing. So we did this press conference, and in the New York Times, supposedly my liberal hometown of New York City, supposedly this left-wing publication, the New York Times, person after person after person posted how correct Costco was not to accept food stamps because they're keeping out those people or these people. Now, for you in radio, I'm making very cliched air quotes, which you should never do, but my experience, the term these people, those people, is often code word. You know, it's not polite in American society, thank God, to use the N-word anymore, but often this is very coded. And they said, these people are smelly, they're dirty, they're dangerous, they're crooked. I am glad to shop in a Costco where people don't get food stamps. And this happens time and time again. I hear comments like this around the country. Someone, you know, will ask me about all the fraudulent people on food stamps. And I got to tell you, the percentage of fraud in food stamps is dwarfed by the percentage of fraud in AIG or your average legislative body in the United States from a factual basis. Now, I'm not just saying that's hyperbole. You look at the actual fraud rates, the average state legislature, the average, you know, congressional session is going to have more people going to jail in the, from the food stamps program. And so my point in this is one of the continual underpinnings of opposition to a more robust safety net in America has been racism. It's an uncomfortable reality to deal with, but I suggest in my book, and I detail it in mind-numbing detail, that a lot of people opposed to the expansion of these programs were Southern segregationists who dramatically opposed any help to non-white people. And America has often believed that everyone getting help is non-white, or the majority of people getting help is non-white. The majority of people poor are non-white, the majority of people hungry are non-white, the majority of people on welfare are non-white. And by the way, today in America, only about 10% of the people in poverty are on welfare. So when we equate welfare with poverty, that's just not true. And it's also not true to think the majority were non-white. Throughout American history, the majority of people poor have been white. Now that's probably less of a hard sell here in Maine. You don't have a huge non-white population here. If you do, you're hiding it well. I've yet to see it, but that is how people think around the country. And part of what I talk about is that in Western Europe, where they traditionally had more of a robust safety net than America, they're actually scaling back that safety net a bit, learning all the wrong lessons from America. And I suggest the reason they're doing so is because their countries are becoming less white and less like themselves, so as more it's not we're helping people just look like us, we're helping other people, then all of a sudden they have problems with the safety net. So despite all this racism that came out when these doctors documented this problem, two amazing things occurred. Dr. Martin Luther King's Poor People's Movement pressured to put anti-hunger work at the centerpiece of what they were doing, and we sort of learned growing up, and I did, that the Poor People's Movement just sort of ended after King died. Well, that's not entirely true. One of their top agenda items was the creation of a modern nutrition assistance safety net, number one. Number two, CBS News had 50 minutes in primetime television, a documentary, Hunger in America, that blew the lid off this problem in America, showed a premature, malnourished baby dying on screen. This was an amazing all-star team of people. It was narrated by Charles Kuralt, directed by Edward R. Murrow. Any of you guys see Good Night and Good Luck? The movie about Edward R. Murrow, what he did at McCarthy, I think his other great achievements, what he did on poverty. And this was produced by Fred Friendly, the character played by George Clooney in the movie. And I can announce today, by the way, George Clooney is going to play me in the movie version of the book. Although I've told him he's going to have to buff up a little and lose a little weight to be credible. Anyway, these things worked. Richard Nixon, running for president, basically denied hunger in America was a problem. He said, oh, my political opponents are just making this up to try to embarrass the Republicans. Within a year, he held the first and only White House conference on hunger. And it wasn't just window dressing. It accomplished very significant things. Created the Women's, Infants, and Children Program. Created the first federal anti-hunger agency. Laid the seeds for the first major expansion of the food stamps program. And following that, Senator Bob Dole, a conservative Republican from Kansas, and Senator George McGovern, a liberal Democrat from South Dakota, teamed up in the Senate and helped create the modern federal nutrition assistance safety net in the mid-70s. By the late 1970s, these programs almost entirely ended hunger in America. By the late 1970s, these programs almost entirely ended hunger in America. I focus on this so much because people today just don't believe you can end it. So because they don't believe you can end it, all they believe is the best we can do is have a little extra charity. But when you understand history that we almost ended it, if you dramatically reduce crime by placing more cops on the street, you don't say, okay, we don't need cops anymore. You say, let's put a few more and finish the job. That's not what we did with poverty. We took the cops off the street, we ended the war on poverty, and we went backwards. Let me give you just one more secular parable. I talk about bucket brigades throughout the country. You know about them here. I understand Portland burnt down 4 times. And I understand, I was told, historians correct me if I was told incorrectly, but I was told by a very wise person, so I'm sure it's true. It was required under either municipal law in Portland or state law, I believe, to actually man a bucket brigade. That is part of your civic obligation to do it. In many places, it was voluntary. These made us feel great. They were sort of the faith-based armies of compassion of their time. People weren't paid. They just showed up as good civic folks, and they carried the water, carried the water. They'd run back to the well. For radio, I'm running back to an imaginary well. And one bucket at a time, one bucket at a time. These were great. They were the best of America. Alexis de Tocqueville, came to America, this great French writer, and said, what makes America different is we have this whole system of voluntary organizations that do this work. We don't have big government like old Europe. There's only one problem with the bucket brigades. You know from here, Portland burned down 4 times. Chicago, Mrs. O'Leary's cow knocks over a lantern, maybe. Chicago's gone. There are big earthquakes in San Francisco and Seattle. Boom, the city's gone from the fire, not the earthquake. Raise your hand one more time if any of you have lived in a major American city that's entirely burnt to the ground. In your lifetime? No one raised their hand saying it happened in their life. What happened? Recurring theme, government solve the problem. See these walls? They're not built out of paper mache anymore. This building has exits required by law, fire alarms required by law, sprinklers required by law. In most places, we would case bucket brigades, volunteer fire departments with professional paid fire departments, so they're paid to be on call. And even in wonderful parts of the United States where there are volunteer fire departments still doing this work, they're often equipped and trained by government. And as wonderful as the bucket brigades were, remember it used to get cold in February? Well, not everyone used to show up for the bucket brigades. Now, let me ask this. Your house is burning down. You're on your third floor with your cat. Which would you prefer? And let me tell you one more thing. One morning at 3 a.m., I calculated that a bucket brigade, if you were lucky, could deliver 60 gallons of water a minute. And a professional fire truck can deliver 1,000 gallons of water a minute today. Which would you prefer? A volunteer bucket brigade, which may or may not show up, which may or may not run out of water, that can deliver 60 gallons of water a minute, or a professional fire company that delivers 1,000 gallons of water a minute, and they are paid to be on call no matter when there is a fire? They will show up because our tax dollars are paying them to be there. I think I know the answer. Why am I telling you this secular parable? Because when it comes to fighting hunger, we've conned the country on the belief we can solve the problem with the bucket brigades of today. Instead of one bucket at a time, one can at a time, one can at a time, one can at a time. Now let me say that our feeding agencies in America today play an absolutely vital role. There are some on the left who say they should go away tomorrow and people will rise up and demand social justice and we'll get a better world. I reject that vehemently. They are absolutely vital to have today. Number one, poor people can't eat social justice. They need food. Number two, the most progressive food banks and feeding agencies are using these places as organizing areas to get people food stamps, to get people nutrition education, to help people access jobs, to advocate for government policies to change these things. So I am not saying these need to go away, but I am saying believing that they alone can solve the problem is just not realistic. Believing we can end hunger with a few more canned food drives is like believing we can fill the Grand Canyon with a teaspoon. Year after year after year, our food banks, food pantries, soup kitchens, food rescue organizations are giving out more and more charitable food, and every year, more and more people are going to these agencies. It's not because we lack food in America. It's because we lack livable wage jobs where people are earning enough to feed their families, and we lack a safety net that fills in for those people who don't earn enough in those jobs to solve the problem. I actually calculated in my book that all the feeding agencies in America provide about $3 billion worth of food a year. That's a lot. There are 36.2 million Americans living in food insecurity in America. Now, I said it's not as bad as 1910. What is it? It's people choosing between food and rent. It's people choosing between food and medicine. It's people rationing food. And ironically, it's people becoming obese because they can't afford enough healthy food or it just doesn't exist in their neighborhood. Now, a lot of people don't believe me, so I have a whole chapter in my book called Is America Fat or Is It Hungry? And I basically prove, I hope beyond a shadow of a doubt, that when you are poor and good food doesn't exist in your neighborhood, or if it does, it's unaffordable, you have to buy the most filling food. And then everyone will tell me, oh, well, if they cooked it from scratch, it would be healthier. And I say, that's nice, but poor people are working one, two, three jobs. They're someone's nanny, and they also happen to be the nanny for their own kids. And they're traveling by public transportation. They're no longer on welfare anymore. And then we say, oh, you got to cook everything from scratch. I just don't think that's realistic. And I just don't think we should have double standards. The poor people have to be uniquely and marvelously more virtuous than the rest of us on half the time. All these problems cost our society $90 billion a year because hungry children learn less well, hungry workers work less well, hungry and food insecure and obese people through poverty cause obesity cost our society tens of billions of dollars a year. I've calculated we can entirely end hunger in America by having $24 billion more of food purchasing power for low-income people. Now, let me ask you, a good old Maine handyman or handy woman comes to your house and says, you know what, I found a hole in your roof. You're losing 90 bucks a year in heating costs because you have a hole in the roof. I can fix it for 24. If you had that 24, wouldn't you do it? I think you would. What's my plan? I hope in the Q&A we can talk more about my specific plan. One, go back to a time of living wage jobs. People working hard and playing by the rules should earn enough to feed their families, and government should have a role in ensuring that, and business executives should have the moral responsibility to, instead of having 7 vacation homes and paying their workers so little they go hungry, let's say that I'm a capitalist, I really am, I think they should work hard and get a vacation, but have 5 vacation homes and use the savings from your other 2 to feed your feed your workers enough. Henry Ford, no leftist he. 3 vacation homes, some of the audience says, okay, we'll argue over that. Henry Ford, a conservative man, understood he had to pay his workers enough so they could buy his cars. One of the reasons we are in this economic collapse is big companies have not paid their workers enough to be able to afford their services. 2, we need a more robust safety net. It should be easier to get food stamps and WIC and these programs. Yes, we need all the fraud prevention we can have. We ought to prevent fraud at AIG, and yes, fraud of poor people, but when poor people get an extra penny, the country goes nuts. When AIG gets extra billions, they fall asleep. So yes, we need to make the safety net easier to get with fraud protection, but also less spending on massive government bureaucracy that keeps food away from people. We are wasting billions and billions and billions of dollars keeping food away from people. My conservative idea is to reduce that bureaucracy and use the money for families. We need a robust safety net for children, including universal schools and first period classrooms. We need more community food security, community gardens, farmers markets, community support agriculture. But please, any of you foodies out there, do not think that is a substitute for the wages or the safety net. Some foodies come to you. If every poor person grow their own food. As unrealistic as that is in Southern California or Southern Florida, in New York where I live, or here in Maine, you do not have 12-month growing seasons. I like eating 12 months out of the year. I don't know about you. And this idea everything should be local, telling a person from Puerto Rico they can never eat a plantain again is pretty darn class bias. So we need community food security. We need to support local food projects. But that's got to be part of this broader solution. And we need a serious attack on poverty. We do all those things. We can end hunger in America. We still have this problem. I told you it's not as bad as Somalia or North Korea. I saw someone at a subway station the other day taking food out of a garbage can. A rabbi told me someone sidled up to them at Starbucks and ate crumbs off their plate after they left. A school official in New York told me they saw a kid going through the garbage behind their school to get food. I cite a study in my book of poor people in rural Kentucky who had to choose between cancer medicine and food. 36 million Americans, a population bigger than the entire state of California, live in American homes that can't afford enough food. Maine has had one of the highest increases in hunger of any state in the union. 13% of the people in Maine now live in households that can't afford food. So we need to do those things we laid out, and we need to make sure food banks, food pantries, food rescue organizations have the resources they need to fill in the gaps. We need to go back to when charities are filling into the gaps, using their expertise, what they do best, innovation, personalization, responding quickly to emergencies, and government goes back to its does best. I'm not saying eliminate the role of charities. I run a nonprofit group. After you send the Good Shepherd Food Bank and Preble Street all the money you get, send us the rest. That being said, we need a balanced approach. I'm going to come back here in the 10th anniversary of this rant and work with you and celebrate that you helped with me and everyone here build a movement to end hunger in America. What used to be inevitable in America is now unthinkable. We used to have slavery. People were sold because of their skin color. That was inevitable. Now it's unthinkable. We used to have child labor. Kids 6, 8, 9 years old, breaker boys worked in anthracite coal mines, would lose fingers, would lose arms, would get black lung, die in their teens for pennies a month. Twice, the United States Supreme Court ruled that Congress could not ban child labor, and yet today, it is unthinkable. I want you to work to build a movement to end this problem once and for all. 10th year anniversary, we come back and say, we lived in a country where people had to eat crumbs off of someone else's plate. Today, that's unthinkable. We lived in a country where cancer patients had to choose between cancer medicine and food. That's unthinkable. We lived in a country where you may have lost fishing jobs, where you may have lost shipbuilding jobs, and because people are working, can't afford to feed their families anymore. That's unthinkable. We lived in a country where kids had to get food out of the trash bin in back of their school. With your help, we're going to make that unthinkable too. Thank you. Hope I wasn't too slow. I want to leave time for questions. I particularly want to offer this to anyone who disagrees with me to go first, because I was at one reading, no one complains, no one came up to me afterwards, and then they put a blog up saying this jerk didn't want to hear what we had to say because we disagreed with him. So start with the people who think I'm this horrible, rabid, you know, right-winger, or we're in Portland, maybe you think I'm too... people think I'm a horrible, rabid left-winger, but I'm in Portland, maybe you think I'm too right-wing, because I defended capitalism. Go ahead.
I don't disagree with you, but I have a question, and it's particular from what Professor, is it Labbe? I missed his name. What he said, I moved here from New Hampshire a few years ago, and I worked in a school system that had was a lower middle class becoming upwardly mobile. And at the end of the year in New Hampshire, where we do not have taxes, people would always, every year, there would be
people
saying,
don't have income taxes.
No income tax, no sales tax. So people would come up at the end of the year and say, we're moving to Maine, because in Maine, we can get on welfare tomorrow. So when we hear about the increase in hunger in Maine, I often wonder, this is the negative side of me, but I often wonder if it's because so many people come here because it is so easy to get services. And if it is easy to get services, then yes, we're going to have an increase in hunger because we have more people.
That's an excellent question, but I have to say I not shockingly disagree, and I think the facts show. First of all, it is never, ever, ever easy in America to get poor people services. You have to wait a day or two or three online. You're treated like a criminal. When you file your income taxes, even if you're a billionaire, you have far, far, far less paperwork than you do to get your dollar a meal for food stamps. I have never met people who spend their lives trying to get on the dole, and that is their goal for life. That being said, let's look at the facts. We have had a dramatic, dramatic, dramatic reduction in welfare. In the early 90s, about half the poor people in America were on welfare. Now it's 10%. The conservatives said if we did that, which we did, that if we reduced teenage pregnancy, which we did, that if we reduced crime, which we did, then those were all the causes of poverty, then of course poverty would go away. We did all those things, and poverty skyrocketed. So we tried their way. It's not my opinion, not ideology, it's just the facts of what happened. It did not work. Now, I have a very nuanced chapter in my book about welfare reform. I work for President Clinton. I actually support the goals of welfare reform. I support his decision, very controversial, to sign the bill, because the previous system stunk. It was bad for poor people. It was bad for taxpayers. But what was a mixed bag in the 1990s when we had a good economy has been a disaster since then. We are not moving people to living wage jobs. We are moving people to the street. And Mississippi has a far higher rate of hunger than Maine, and I guarantee people from Maine aren't moving to Mississippi for the right to be on social service programs. So I just say, you know, let's look at the facts. When people say by dramatically reducing taxes on the rich, we're going to save the American economy and reduce the deficit, we've done that. What happened? You know, we know what reduces poverty. We know what doesn't. You know, we shouldn't have theoretical debates over this stuff anymore. There's a thing called social science. You know, there's math, 1 + 1 = 2. And when you dramatically decrease revenues by cutting taxes on the mega-rich and cutting social programs, it doesn't reduce poverty. It increases them. So I'm not saying there's never been a person in the world undeserving on welfare. But there are a lot of people undeserving on farm subsidies. Some of you, as I get a mortgage interest deduction for my house, people who live in apartments do not get that. There are plenty of subsidies. Wealthier people get, the poor people do not. And not everyone getting a mortgage interest deduction is virtuous. That's what I call the Paris Hilton rule. Ma'am, hold on a second.
How is the hunger rate measured? It's not measured, is it, by people who actually have food stamps, is it?
No. Food stamps is one indication of hunger, but it plays both ways because when people get food stamps, they reduce their hunger. Often, however, some of the hungriest people get food stamps, and some of the hungriest people aren't eligible for food stamps. Many immigrants are not eligible for food stamps. The way the government measures hunger, and not get too wonkish on you, there is a 21-point scale of questions asked by USDA through Census Bureau questionnaires, and they ask a series of questions about food intake, food sufficiency, what you're buying, what you worry about buying, and if you get to a certain level of that, you are described as food insecure, which may or may not mean you're hungry. If you're most severe, we used to call that hunger. The Bush administration actually stopped using the term hunger and started using very low food security. I think that's bogus. If we all can complain we're hungry before going to Becky's for a beautiful breakfast, then I think poor people can say if they're missing meals, they can be considered hungry. Another proxy is how many people go into soup kitchens and food pantries. In 2005, according to America's Second Harvest, an organization now called Feeding America, there were 25 million Americans going to food pantries and soup kitchens. So there's no really precise way. The census data doesn't even include homeless people. It's only people in homes. So the very hungriest people aren't even counted by the government. So it really is a problem far vaster than Americans understand. Just because we're not Somalia, I say that's a very low bar in a country that last year had 400 billionaires.
Hi, I'm Diane Dunton, and I'm chair for Good Shepherd Food Bank, and we are feeding over 70,000 people in the state of Maine right now, and that continues to increase, and we're distributing over 10 million. And I hear a lot that you're saying, but the corporate responsibility of not just giving the dollars out, but recognizing that the employees that are working there are hungry today. And many times it's a dignity issue. How many people in this room want to say that I was hungry? Who wants to walk into the food bank, the food pantry? It's hitting all of us, and it's growing. And we have to find ways to help people.
I agree. And one of the things I talk about in my book is some companies that donate a lot of food to food banks and food pantries and soup kitchens, honestly, are some of the ones that don't pay their workers enough to avoid having to use food pantries and soup kitchens. Now, I don't say it's either or. Some on the left would say, okay, stop doing those donations and pay your workers more. I happen to think they can do both. I don't mean to pick on Walmart because they've been very generous, but they announced a major donation to feeding charities across the country, and I calculated that if they paid their workers a dollar more an hour, that would have dwarfed the food purchasing power of their donation. And by the way, the net worth of the family that founded Walmart now is about $100 billion. Now, I calculated that extra dollar an hour per worker in America would be about $1 billion. That's a lot of money to you and I hope, but that's 1/100th of the net worth. So I hardly think it's socialist to say that people without government requirements should just say the right thing to do in America is to pay our workers enough. And you can say our steel plant may go overseas. Your Walmart's not going overseas. Your local restaurant isn't going overseas. Your local gas station isn't going overseas. Your cleaning people at night in your company aren't going overseas. Your drivers aren't going overseas. Your security guards aren't going overseas. And those are all people who are the most underpaid. The jobs that are least likely to be shipped overseas are the ones that are often most underpaid. So I just don't think that's an excuse. And, you know, even in this down economy, some of big executives, particularly on Wall Street, are making lots of money. They're still getting huge subsidies of my tax dollars. Goldman Sachs is getting this whole boatload of money. They're giving out huge, they're getting money from the TARP, but they're also getting huge money from New York City to build a new corporate headquarters. And I just suggest that if we're against, you know, welfare, as we should be, you know, everyone should do their fair share. So I thank you, and I thank you for Good Shepherd's amazing vital work every day. And again, everyone listening, send them money, send Preble Street money, volunteer, and just don't volunteer around the holidays. Give your professional skills. Small pantries and kitchens really need accountants. They need PR people. It's nice to come and move cans, but, you know, a junior high school kid can do that. We want everyone to do and learn about the problem, but they really need your long-term help.
Great. Please join me in thanking Joel Berg for coming today.
You've been listening to Joel Berg, leading national expert on U.S. hunger, on Speaking in Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, it will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for a listing of available programs. This and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs will be available to stream on demand or to download as a podcast. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.